Good afternoon. Welcome to another episode of Queer Talk. This is F. Daniel Kent. I'm going to be your special guest host today. And today we're going to be doing another segment of Queer Soup, focusing on queer entertainment throughout the country. Today I'm going to be having a lively discussion with singer-songwriter, Tony-nominated performer, and now author of the excellent book, Tango, My Life Backwards and in High Heels, as well as the album that was recently released, Dendrophile, which is incredible if you haven't heard it yet. After that, we'll be talking with the author of Celluloid Activist, The Life and Times of Vito Russo, Mr. Michael Schiavi. But first, we're going to listen to a track from Dendrophile, a song that many of you will remember from the movie Short Bus, in which Justin was featured prominently. The song is In the End, written by Scott Matthew and Scott William Matthew. Enjoy. That was mixed Justin Vivian Bond, In the End, from the album Dendrophile. Singer, songwriter, and Tony-nominated performer Mix Justin Vivian Bond is an Obie, Bessie, and Ethel Eichelberger Award winner. As one half of the performance duo Kiki and Herb, Bond has toured the world, headlining at Carnegie Hall, the Symphony Opera House, and London's Queen Elizabeth Hall, and starring in Kiki and Herb on Broadway. Film credits include a role in John Cameron Mitchell's feature Short Bus. Bond recently released a record called Dendrophile and is writing a play with Sandra Bernhardt. With recent profiles in Paper Magazine, New Yorker, New York Magazine, Out Magazine, and Vogue, Justin Vivian Bond has sparked a lively discussion about gender fluidity and growing up trans in America. Raised in suburban Maryland, the boy who would become mixed Justin Vivian Bond is actually aware of being different. Teased and ostracized by the bully next door, Justin is surprised when that same boy wants to meet secretly and they develop a sexual relationship fresh out of the Boy Scouts. Framed in the present, Mix Bond is recently diagnosed with ADD and discovers that this lover from childhood has been remanded to a mental institution, having been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. This odd coincidence sends Mix Bond on a journey back to childhood to address V's traumatic childhood relationship. With simplicity, humor, and compassion, this daring literary debut conjures the drama of growing up queer or trans in America. Tango, My Childhood Backwards and in High Heels, is the story of enduring a conservative family and repressive community values to ultimately find meaning in friendship and unabashed self-exploration. I'd like to welcome Mix Justin Vivian Bond to the show. Welcome.
Hello.
Let's talk about your album.
Okay.
Dendrophile. I know you've released EPs before, but this being your first album, what was in your head as far as wanting to really make it as big as it possibly could be?
Well, I wasn't really thinking about in terms of it being as big as it possibly could be, because I wouldn't even know how to go about that. I was just trying to think of making a record that I would want to listen to, because I know people enjoyed the Kiki and Herb records, but that's not really the kind of thing that I enjoy listening to, because I like things that are a bit more, you know, soothing, I guess.
Right.
But, my idea was, because I think when people see my live shows and like Joe's Pub or various venues, they sort of feel like they're in my living room, so there's a kind of an intimacy involved. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to make a record that wasn't so much like a performance, but a record that would be almost like I was singing directly, quietly to a few people in a small room, or even directly to the person who is listening to it. So I wanted it to sound really intimate and personal. And so that was really the primary thing I wanted as far as sound went. And Thomas Bartlett, who is also a dove man, his music is very sensitive and quiet, and I like the sort of way that, and so I thought he would be a good fit as far as producing it, and I also knew he would bring in some great musicians that I really admired, and so that was really, getting him to agree to do it was pretty important, because then I was lucky enough to get Sam Amadon, who plays banjo and sings back up on Equipoise, and Shahzad Ismaili, who did drums and on most of the tracks. So, and then as far as thematically, I was, before I decided on the name Dendrophile, I was thinking of calling it Luster, because Luster's my fairy name.
I didn't know that.
and so it was going to be called Luster, but then I decided not to call it Luster, and it took me a long time to figure out what to call it, because I was thinking in terms of Luster when I was putting the song list together, but once the whole record was kind of put together, I thought of Dendrophile, because my beloved traveling companion Nathan was the one that introduced me to that term, Dendrophile, and I thought it was really great, because I knew that because I wrote so many of the songs actually on Short Mountain, and I thought it would be a great sort of way to discuss the record.
great mix of your own work, and then people who have seen you perform have grown accustomed to these great covers of songs that you do. And you've covered so many great things. How did you go about deciding what you were going to put on the album, given the limited amount of space that you had? And I'm sure you had a ton of other stuff that you've written, other things that you've written that didn't make the album.
Well, I knew from the very beginning that I wanted to have Golden Age of Hustlers on their Bambi Lake song.
And that's an amazing song.
It's a beautiful song. I love singing the song, and I feel it's so evocative of something and a time and a place, and not even just geographically, but mentally and emotionally. I wanted that. That was a prime motivation for even recording, because that I wanted to get that song out for people to hear, because it's such a gorgeous song. So that song was the first one, so that was kind of a no-brainer. And then let's see, what else did I cover? I covered let me get my you'd think I'd know all this by heart, but I don't. And 22nd Century is another song that is I wasn't complete. Well, it's a song that I felt somehow just really resonates with the time that we're living in. And it was written by Exuma and recorded by Nina Simone. But I found when I was performing it live, people responded to it so intensely that was one that just kind of gave me an opportunity to really kind of like let loose in a way that a lot of the other songs didn't. So I put that on there because it sort of is almost like it could be a diary for many of us, because of the way that it kind of 1980, a plague struck the earth and blah blah blah, and it goes up to tomorrow will be the 22nd century, and I think it sort of leaves the door open for us to determine what the 22nd century is going to be like. So you can either leave it with a kind of optimistic feeling, or you can take a real sort of apocalyptic feeling from it, depending on, you know, how you look at things.
Well, your vocals get really intense on that one too. You really are belting out that near the end, just really going into it. And
for me, it's a kind of a cathartic song, you know. I feel like, you know, it's good to just let it out in that one.
Well, Justin, thank you so much for joining us today. We're going to take a short break and let you listen to another song from Dendrophile. If you are interested in either Dendrophile or Tango, My Childhood Backwards and in High Heels, Justin Vivian Bond's memoir of childhood, you can go to www.justinbond.com. And here is Justin Vivian Bond once again with Jeunet Song.
Hoping you'll bring a revival, or I'm moving on.
My next guest is Michael Schiavi. Michael is Associate Professor of English and Coordinator of English as a Second Language at the New York Institute of Technology's Manhattan campus. His articles have appeared in Cinema Journal, Theater Journal, Modern Drama, and College Literature. Biographer Michael Schiavi unravels Vito Russo's fascinating life story in his book Celluloid Activist, The Life and Times of Vito Russo, from his childhood in East Harlem to his own heartbreaking experiences with HIV and AIDS. Drawing on archival materials, unpublished letters and journals, and more than 200 interviews, including conversations with a range of Russo's friends and family, from brother Charlie Russo to comedian Lily Tomlin to pioneering activist and playwright Larry Kramer. Celluloid Activist provides an unprecedented portrait of a man who defined gay rights and AIDS activism. Michael, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Talk to me a little bit about what your experience with Vito Russo's work before you started working on the book was.
Well, you know, that goes a little bit back to when I was in college. I was 17 years old and closeted and terrified and a major film queen. And I got to American University, where I was an undergrad, and spent a lot of time in the library and noticed there was this book on the shelves called The Celluloid Closet, which was combining two of my favorite topics, homosexuality and film. And I was just amazed to find that, first of all, that such a book existed, that there was a book on both of those topics, and then also that there was someone out there in the world who was so angry and so eloquent about what Hollywood had done to gays and lesbians. And I had no idea. You know, I knew that I was gay, but I had never really said that out loud, and I didn't, you know, feel anything like pride. And here's this guy in his book who's yelling, and, you know, with such great humor and so articulately about gay representation and how we had been done wrong by Hollywood. And I was just so touched by that.
Yeah, how did that experience of reading that book and digesting his work kind of change your perspective as a young gay man?
Oh, it changed me completely. I mean, that was really my first glimpse. You know, as I said, I was only 17. It was my first glimpse that you could be gay and proud. You know, reading The Celluloid Closet, even, you know, reading a lot of films that I didn't necessarily recognize, I had this sense that, you know, he was standing up for his beliefs in fair representation. You know, and as someone who, like most gay kids, I grew up very bullied and took a lot of crap at school. And this was someone who said, you know, Hollywood has been calling us names for a lot of years, and I'm not going to stand for it anymore. Here are all the ways in which we've been hurt. We've been attacked by the mainstream media, and we as a community need to be aware of this so that we can change it, and it never happens again. And that had a huge impact on me.
When, kind of bringing us forward to when you decided to write the book, what were the circumstances surrounding that, and how did the book kind of evolve into the entity that it became?
That's going forward a number of years. I had become a professor of English, and I was specializing in gay performance and gay film and theater. And it came to my attention that The Celluloid Closet in film theory in academic studies today is often trashed, or at least at the time that I was writing this article, which was about 5 years ago. It was seen as, you know, kind of old and passé, and Vito's work was kind of dismissed as simplistic, and, oh, it's all about positive and negative images, and we're much more sophisticated than that. And that really upset me, because I thought it dismissed how landmark The Celluloid Closet was, and that so much of film studies that we have today came from Vito's courage and his vision in declaring what gay images had been. So I decided then to do an article about the place of The Celluloid Closet in film theory today. And when I was doing that article, I contacted Vito's best friend, Arnie Kantrowitz, and his partner, Dr. Larry Math, just to get kind of like an insider angle on what was going in through Vito's head when he wrote the book. And Larry said to me, you know, it's really wonderful that you're writing this article on The Celluloid Closet, but somebody really should write a biography of Vito, because he was so central to gay activism and AIDS activism. And I thought, yeah, somebody should. So I did. And that's how the book came about.
When you were doing the research for this,
tell me a little bit about some of the things that you found that you found most interesting that you hadn't been aware of before.
I only knew the kind of supercharged public persona that Vito had, which was, you know, this incredibly fiery, bright, gay activist, AIDS activist, film critic, that I kind of bought the whole public image completely, and I didn't know that there was so much more to him. You know, I had no idea how much he struggled with poverty to be able to write The Celluloid Closet and all the journalism that he did in the 70s and 80s on behalf of gay rights. You know, he often had no idea where his rent was coming from, where his next meal was coming from. He really lived hand to mouth. I didn't know how insecure Vito often was. Part of the great blessing of this project was that New York Public Library has all of his papers, including about 13 years of journals. And in the journals, he's incredibly painfully honest about wondering, you know, what the next project is going to be, and will audiences accept his work, and is he really communicating as he should? And I just thought he was such a master communicator. I was amazed that he had any moments of doubt. I was amazed to find out how really unlucky in love he was. You know, for someone as charismatic as Vito and as attractive as he was, he had tremendous problems holding on to a relationship, and I had no idea about that. So the research for the book showed me how much more human he was than I had ever suspected.
Do you feel like you were able to adequately, you know, because it sounds like you're talking about someone who is way more complex than anyone has any idea of. Do you feel like in writing the book that you were able to adequately translate that into a workable or an understandable form for those who were not familiar with Vito?
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, it really was one of my main goals when I was writing the book. In fact, when I was just putting together the proposal and it was first being read by University of Wisconsin Press readers, to see whether it should be published at all, one of the readers said, you know, Vito Russo had a fascinating life, but I hope that Michael Schiavi will be careful not to write a saint's life because that's boring. You know, let's realize that nobody is really a saint. This has to be a complex life. It has to be something that's a little bit more nuanced than we might think of as the public persona of Vito Russo. And I thought, yeah, that's absolutely what I want to do. I want to write a full, rounded biography, not something that's trying to whitewash his reputation, because who needs that?
Well, you know, and one of the things that I noted most about the book is that it's not just about Vito, it's about the times that he lived in. And you focus very heavily on, especially in the first half of the book, the culture and the way things were and what his life was like with his family and day-to-day life for your average person living in New York. Talk to me a little bit about the work that went into that and why you felt like that was an important thing to include in this biography.
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I was also determined, in addition to writing a kind of rounded portrait of Vito, I really wanted to show very clearly where he came from. Vito, like everyone, is very much a product of his surroundings, but he had such incredible material to work with. He came from this very rich, pretty volatile Italian-American Catholic background in East Harlem. He was this very bright, often effeminate, very tortured little boy who knew that he was different from a very early age, and this really set him apart and made him start thinking about injustice at quite a young age. I'm sorry, I just lost my train of thought. That you were asking about family, and also New York. I mean, Vito, you know, had the good luck of being a young man right as the gay rights movement was taking off in New York. Stonewall happened when he was only 23. He witnessed it, actually, from the perspective of an elm tree branch where he was kind of afraid of the violence. Just right after Stonewall, as the gay rights movement was taking off in New York, and we had organizations like Gay Liberation Front and Gay Activists Alliance, Vito was becoming really political politically aware, and he joined that that movement very actively and very much helped to shape it. So you can't really tell Vito's story without telling the story of New York City, of gay activism, of what it was like to be Italian-American in the 50s and 60s in New York. He's just such a part of that whole background, and I loved being able to bring that into the book. I hope it translates for readers that way.
I certainly felt like it did. That was one of my favorite parts of the book, was that learning a lot of the underlying cultural causes of certain things that were prevalent in his life. And kind of on that note, Vito was kind of an integral part of gay activism in the 70s in New York, and one of the most visible faces. What do you feel like the legacy of his activism today is? And and not only that, but also from a cinematics point of view, what would you think that his legacy is today?
From a political viewpoint, I think his legacy is that of visibility. Vito came from an era when most of his contemporaries were absolutely closeted and silent and terrified of people knowing who they were. And Vito, maybe more than anybody else of his generation, was so out and so proud and so completely insistent that mainstream heterosexual society deal with gay people, not just in a respectful way, but just deal with them. Just realize that there are gay people, they are your neighbors, they're your children, they're your brothers and sisters, and you have to be aware of them in your midst. And then from there, taking the step to, okay, now that you know who they are, and you know that they're not freaks, and you know that they're people worthy of respect, respect them. Which today sounds like a completely mainstream, normal, recognizable, and easy goal, but at his time, back in the late 60s and the 70s, this was extraordinarily revolutionary. And we have that today because of Vito Russo and people like him, like the Organization of Gay Activists Alliance. None of that would exist today but for that group of people now 40 years ago.
I'd like to thank my guests today, Michael Schiavi and Justin Vivian Bond, for joining us. Queer Talk Radio is a Joyce Arnold production. Archives of Queer Talk Radio can be found at queertalkradio.podomatic.com. This is F. Daniel Kent. Thank you for tuning in. Please join us again next week.